Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Bruna podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I am your host Digjay, and today I have with me Sasha Mirchandani, founder and managing partner at K Capital and co-founder of Mumbai Angels. Sasha is one of the OG angel investors from India, known for making early bets in companies like Fractal, InMobi and Myntra. After his stint with angel investing, Sasha became a venture capitalist and joined Blue Run Ventures as their managing director for India before starting his own VC fund K Capital in 2012. In this episode, Sasha talks about his learnings from investing in startups over the last two decades, from being an angel investor in early 2000s to starting his own VC fund in 2012, about K Capital and how the fund leverages its LPs to add value to their portfolio startups, what it takes to build a legacy institutional VC fund, his list of anti-portfolio startups, and key learnings from these missed investment opportunities. I had a great time chatting with Sasha, and I hope you enjoy this freewheeling conversation discussing all things startups, angel investing, and venture capital. So let's dive into the episode and find out what Sasha has to share. Welcome, Sasha. Welcome to the VC Bruna podcast. Very excited to have you with us on the show.
Thank you for the invite, sir.
Okay, so, you know, for those who don't know you yet, maybe we can start with a brief background before we jump into the questions.
Brief background, I am born and brought up here in Mumbai, went off to the US, came back, worked in my family business for a couple of years, worked in a global firm called Blue Run Ventures, which is formerly Nokia Ventures, for 6 years. I'm also co-founder of an angel club called Mumbai Angels. And then I founded K Capital in 2011, 2012. Basically, I'm an early stage venture capitalist.
And while you modestly just said that, you know, these are two, three things that you did, there's a lot to unpack, you know, within all those experiences. So let me start with the Mumbai Angels stint and, you know, tell me what led you to start Mumbai Angels in the first place.
So, you know, I'd been making investments, angel investments, since about 2001. And the ticket size was pretty decent, you know, up to maybe $500,000, $1 million. Now, a lot of this money was not mine, it was my father's. So he would kind of say, okay, here's the cash, but go out and make a business plan for me, explain to me why I should use this money to invest. So he was the LP for me. And he was an extremely difficult and tough LP, correctly so, because it was hard-earned money. And so I did that for a couple of years and really enjoyed it. But I realized I wanted to do this myself with my own capital. Limitation I had was I had obviously far less money than he did. And in 2006, me and my very close friend, Prashant Choksi, were having a coffee. And he had the exact same situation. He had made a few investments through his family office, but he wanted to do it himself. And neither of us had the capital. But we knew we could maybe pull in a few lakhs and do deals. So we said, why don't we just join an angel club? And I remember checking the web to look for one next to our house. I couldn't find anything. And the next day, I checked the web again. And sure enough, I said, hey, guess what? There's nothing in India. I'm surprised. So that's how we created Mumbai Angels in 2006. We became one of India's first. And around the exact same time, IAN, Indian Angel Network, started off in Delhi. So we pretty much started our journeys together. I remember calling it Mumbai Angels because I felt it would be very local. The angel investing in the West was very local. So we said Mumbai Angels. Little realizing that the asset class was so early, we'd end up doing a bulk of our deals outside of Mumbai, ironically. And years later, you know, we have chapters across 7, 8, 9 cities, and we still call ourselves Mumbai Angels. So that's one regret. I wish we had more generically, we could have scaled up that particular brand much easier.
Yeah. No, very interesting. So, you know, let me ask you this. When you were doing those angel investments, you know, very early on, what was the common thesis for you, you know, across all those investments? And what were you looking for in the founders that you were investing in at that time?
It was all about the founder. So that's exactly the same thing. We were laser focused on the quality of the founder. And that's what we looked at as a common theme, if you see. Whether we got it right or wrong, the focus was on the founder in those days.
And given, you know, the asset class was so early, I'm sure it would be even more tougher to judge, you know, whether the founder, you know, would be able to build a startup that would scale and give you those kind of returns that an angel investor expects. So what were the particular skill sets that you were looking for in these founders at that time?
Well, you know, the best founders, whether they're in 2002 or 6 or 20, have the same skill sets. Is what I've realized. It's all about experience and stuff like that. But the skill sets are more innate in the sense, how determined is he or she? How quick of a learner is he or she? How curious is he or she? How flexible is he or she? And so on and so forth. Because a lot of times, let's take InMobi. Naveen pivoted 3 times with the model right. But he was super flexible, super quick. On the other hand, Fractal, where Srikanth and Pranay were super determined because it took forever to scale up their business in the early days because data was still very early. They were very determined from day one saying, look, we want to go build a large company and whatever it takes. And so those are, again, the best of best founders. And today, Fractal is an amazing company. But in the early days, times were tough. They were very determined.
Absolutely. So, you know, if you had to go back and just think about it, what were some mistakes that you made early on, you know, that helped you improve as an investor?
Yeah, so we did probably more deals than I should have done. You know, angel investments is a business of doing many. You can't do two and be happy. On the other hand, I think I did more than I should have. We obviously focused on the founder, but we realized 20 years later that founder is critical, but so is the market. So, you know, the market is equally important, sometimes even more important, because you can get a very good founder, but a very bad market, or it's not, market's not ready, and it just becomes very difficult. On the other hand, if you can get a solid, good founder, and in a very good market, a very large market, he or she can then still build a pretty successful company. So, you know, I don't think we spent as much time in the very early days on the market as much as we did on the founder. If we had married the two, I think we would have done even better. Also, we put too little in each company. I believe anything in life is about conviction. So once you have conviction on something, I would like to put a little bit more money per company in some of those businesses. Because the ones where I put more money, where I had conviction, they did really well. But I didn't do it in enough of my companies. I wish I had done more.
Got it. And how do you, you know, get that conviction? Because again, it's like you said, you know, you're judging the founder and you don't have many data points to rely on to double down on your initial investment.
Do your diligence, or whatever diligence you feel is appropriate, right? We have a certain X that we have to do. Then either you're in or out in life, right? You can't be in the middle. So either you're in and say, okay, all in or all out. All this dabbling and saying, okay, I'm not sure, but let me try. It never works. And then you always regret either having put too much or too little. So once you're sure, then even if it fails, you should be happy and move on.
Yeah, I think that's incredible advice for, you know, all young angel investors who are just starting off on that journey. You know, I want to talk about that transition that you were making from angel investing to starting K Capital. What is the biggest difference in approach and criteria, you know, when you're making investments as an angel versus, you know, as a venture capitalist running a fund?
You know, the angel, you're doing it on your own. Your ability to do diligence is limited because you're an individual person, unless you have a consortium. Versus in a fund, it's a full-time job, right? So when we have K Capital, say our fund, me and my colleagues, partners, etc., it's 24/7 job for us. So we have a full team and we're doing diligence 24/7 on these entrepreneurs. It makes a massive difference. Secondly, I'm managing somebody else's capital. So obviously you have to be far more prudent versus, you know, writing a check on my own. I just said, you know, I got to do X amount of diligence, but if it's my own money today, if say you're pitching me something on this podcast and I like it, what's to stop me from writing a check? But on the other hand, the same pitch, if it is for K Capital, I would obviously like it the same amount, but the diligence I would do is dramatically different.
And, you know, just flipping the frame of reference from a founder perspective, you know, VCs today, they're going downstream and well-known VCs are writing checks at seed stage and even at pre-seed stage, you know, even before the MVP is out. So how do they decide if they should, you know, approach an angel investor or a fund which is, you know, ready to write a pre-seed check for them?
I think the most important thing is just back channel on through other founders on the angel or the fund. Not enough people do this. Many smart founders are now doing this much more than before, which I think is great because I can say whatever I want about myself. That's really irrelevant, right? It's what my customers for me are who? Are the entrepreneurs and the investors in our funds. If the entrepreneur is happy, he or she will tell you why they're happy and what value we've added versus me telling you. That adds a world of difference. So I encourage people to speak to companies that we funded in the past and then make your own opinion.
Makes sense. So, you know, tell us about K Capital. You know, what's the thesis, the fund size and portfolio composition like today? And what kind of founders do you aim to back through K Capital?
So we're very early stage, pre-seed most of the times. Sometimes there's some early traction. Many a time it's still a laptop plan. In fact, the last two deals out of the last four are laptop plans, no revenue, no traction, nothing. Just maybe 2-3 months of traction at best, right? So very early. So like I said, we are sector agnostic. We like to pick a couple of sectors at a time, go deep into those categories, figure out if we want to play in those categories or not. And if we do, we go find something around that category. On the other hand, you get a lot of inbound deal flow like pretty much every other VC fund. So we can be opportunistic once in a while and say, okay, this looks really good for these reasons. And we could invest as well from there. As far as categories are concerned, I think this is a constant wave. So sometimes we're very worried about just getting into the next hot thing. Because a lot of times the categories actually go nowhere. So it's like, do we really want to be part of this hot wave? And a lot of times we say, not really. Let it go. Sometimes we miss out, sometimes we don't. But that's life. It's okay.
So what are the sectors that you're, you know, currently excited about?
SaaS for sure has become a big focus for us. A lot of our SaaS companies are doing really well. D2C brands in our portfolio are doing really well. I think across the sector, B2B commerce, which, you know, is an India problem. Some of our best companies are in that category right now and scaling exponentially. Logistics, we have companies doing really well. So across the board, actually.
Got it. So, you know, I want to talk a bit about the LPs, you know, that K Capital has. And just like founders have to choose the right VCs, there's an element of VCs having the right LPs to leverage upon to support those founders. So what factors should GPs consider when deciding which LPs to raise funds from?
Very good question. I hope that you know, we can all be in that position where we can pick our own LPs. And that happens, and many funds are very much in that position. But it takes years, decades sometimes to be in that position for most funds. Today, like a Sequoia US or Lightspeed US, maybe even Sequoia India, Lightspeed India, can pick and choose who they want because to their credit, they performed. And they can actually say, you know what, we don't want this fund or we don't want this. Versus most of the other funds really are not in that position to the extent that they can get pretty much 100%. But as we evolve, as now we reach fund three, I think we've reached the stage where we can actually now kind of pick who we want. Are we there yet to perfection? Not really, but we are on track to getting there. And it's a very, very important thing because it's a very long journey we have with LPs. And it can take decades. So our goal is to get to 90-95% at least of LPs that we want, if not 100%. We're not there yet, but hopefully by the next fund, we should be there.
And what do you particularly look for, you know, in those LPs? What are the kind of qualities that you're looking for?
You know, LPs capital, right? A lot of times LPs will invest in a fund, not understanding the asset class. So it's our job to educate them and explain how this works. And if we don't do a good enough job, then we can't be complaining about the LP after 6 months of taking their capital. So I've got to do enough diligence to understand if this LP really understands by talking to other people that he or she may have invested in. And if they never invest in the fund, try and spend time explaining how reporting is done, how funds do take time to exit out. Because, you know, most of our funds are 10 years plus, right? And most LPs come in with open eyes saying, yeah, it's okay. But then realize after 5, 6, 7 years saying, hold on, you still haven't given me your money back. And that was never the deal anyway. It was a 10-year fund. So sometimes we have to face this 5 years into a fund. But I realized that there are certain people and certain profiles now who kind of don't fit. And so I spend a little bit more time with them before they commit, spending time explaining to them, look, sir or madam, this is the issue. Are you sure? And at least then they appreciate that we've told them upfront versus taking their money and then saying, too bad.
Yeah, definitely helpful advice for, you know, a lot of new VC funds that are coming up and looking for that kind of capital. And a lot of founders, like you rightly said, you know, look at not just the GPs, but kind of LPs that are backing these funds. So how are you leveraging your LPs, you know, in supporting your portfolio companies? And if you could share, you know, one or two examples of startups where you've leveraged your LPs.
Oh, many, many ways. They open doors for us. In fact, I can give you today itself, right? I've had LPs open a door for one company today. I've had one LP offer to take us to the RBI because one of our portfolio companies is raising capital and they're stuck at the RBI because of some rules that had changed and they're stuck for 6 months. They can't take the second tranche of their private equity money. This LP is a very prominent lawyer. He's willing to take us there. He knows our case is solid, but it's just taken us that long and, you know, he'll hopefully get us through. He had taken us in the past as well for another company that got done in 24 hours, as an example.
Yeah.
Correct? There were other LPs who were, you know, consultants and partners in PwC, EY. They helped give tax advice. When we had the lockdown, we had lawyer LPs give us advice on force majeure and other things, which would not have, these entrepreneurs probably not have access to that quality of lawyer, if not for these guys being LPs in our fund. And also they can put another example from just today is, you know, our funds are small. So as the companies raise more capital, these LPs are very wealthy. Like you're talking about whether it be endowments, whether it be fund of funds, whether it be HNIs, family offices. So they can actually come in and co-invest with us in our later rounds when we are out of cash. That's another example of where LPs can be super helpful.
Sasha, I want to, you know, switch gears and talk about exits now. And a lot has been talked about, you know, the investment criteria, but we don't hear VCs talk about the exit criteria. How do you decide what's the right time and the best time to exit a particular investment?
Actually, this is the most important question. And, you know, to your previous question on some of the mistakes, especially in my angel days, 100% my biggest mistakes in my angel days was actually exits. Either staying on too long or getting out too early. So I don't think people spend enough time on their exits as much as they spend on actually the entries into these companies. And do remember, anyone can invest. If you have 10 rupees to throw 10 bucks into a company, you don't need to be a genius. But really understanding the business after you have invested and deciding whether you need to stay on, take some off the table, and so on and so forth is very, very important. And therefore, understanding where the founder is going, do you want to partner with him or her over a longer period of time, seeing the value in the business. Many other facets of a company and your investments are very, very important. And I think I made some rushed exits, too fast in some cases, where the returns were actually pretty good, 3x, 5x, even up to 10x in one company. But for the example, the 10x company could have been 500x. I'm just making up a number. Whereas hundreds of x, right? Only 3 to 4 years after I exited. And not because I didn't know the company was doing well, but just think, okay, it's good enough. It wasn't enough thought. So you've got to put far more thought into your exits. Now, as K Capital, because like I said, it's not our money, our thought process in exits is immense. And I wish I'd given the same diligence of the diligence we do on exits in K to my angel video. I would have made far more money.
Right. And are there any specific metrics that come to your mind that, you know, you specifically look at?
No metrics. It's all about the business. So sometimes we have a one-third model where, for example, if a company is now done very well, but we feel that, look, we need to get one-third out, say it's reached Series F, just to risk mitigation strategy, we're happy to take out one-third. And so then we guarantee we're not losing any money in that investment. After that, it really depends on how he or she scales the business. Because see, in venture, the most important thing is you've got to ride your winners to the end. What most people don't realize. Oh, I was in so-and-so company. Okay, how much did you make? 20x. Okay. But if you came in this stage, you should have made, like I said, 300x or 100x. How do you make 20x? We didn't ride it to the end. On the other hand, we have many horror stories where you ride till almost the end and then it becomes the end and you become zero. So you say, oh, you were in so-and-so company and you made zero. How is that possible? It was worth 2 billion at peak because he or she didn't take some off the table. So I know people who made money even in companies that have crashed and become zero because they managed to at least get off at every step.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, you know, risk mitigation and giving, you know, more thought on when to exit, of course. I wanted to talk about your anti-portfolio as well. And if you could, you know, name some startups from your anti-portfolio that you wish you had invested in.
So many. I mean, I can go through like we want to list of companies. Obviously, like every VC, you say the same thing. We say the same thing. You don't regret it. But of course, you regret it because it's a business is to get into the best companies, right? So I don't regret, like I'm not a person of personality that regrets and cries at home. We tell ourselves, learn from that mistake of why you passed on him or her. And next time, be more agile to get it done. And so that you don't have to cry about it. Obviously, we miss yet another company as we go. Today, maybe just today itself, maybe I miss the next big unicorn. Because, you know, our business is of such a high velocity of deal flow that there is a propensity to miss. Every single fund on earth misses. Even Sequoia US, which is the best fund on earth, I'm sure still misses so many great deals. That's part of life. But I've said this before many times, same companies, whether it be Ola, Oyo, Delivery, Meesho, An Academy, and the list goes on. Several other companies that could have done or at least had approached us. And we were in different stages, some from only one meeting, some were two meetings, some were three meetings, but we missed some of these companies.
So what's the process that you try to apply when you're revisiting these deals to, you know, to optimize your investment process?
So it really depends. Sometimes it could be kind of analyze why we missed that deal. We analyze and say, okay, why did me or any of my partners or colleagues say no? And it could be anything. It could be that, you know, why do you say no to him or why didn't you move fast enough? So it could be like, you know, I didn't like this part about this business or I didn't like his or her background or he or she didn't go to a top tier school. It could be something absurd like that also. And we're like, hold on, what stops you from... And then he or she then introspects and says, got it. So next time someone comes along with the same profile, it shouldn't be like a preconceived notion that, okay, let me just move on this one. Or someone is coming across as more aggressive than you feel comfortable. So your internal bias is coming to play and say, you know, I don't feel I'm comfortable with this individual. So let me just pass. I'll find reason to say no. But in life, you've got to manage people. Nobody's going to be cookie cutter and sweet and vanilla. Life is not vanilla, right? Life is about multiple flavors of people. That's why he or she is an entrepreneur and crazy entrepreneur to go build a $1 billion company. So we got to constantly analyze this.
Got it. Makes sense. And I'm sure it's very tough to, you know, digest those anti-portfolio companies, but very important to, you know, just revisit and try to optimize and just think about, you know, what went wrong and what could have been better.
That's right.
Sasha, you've been a veteran, you know, investing in startups. So you've seen founders at different stages, you know, like we alluded to before, you know, the early 2000s, the last decade and the founders of today. What do you think has changed fundamentally in the quality of founders, or maybe in terms of preparedness, the grandness of their vision? What do you think has changed over the years?
I think this success begets success in life, you know. So if I see someone, a peer, doing well, I say, well, I can do it too. The next can do better. Someone can do better. So it's like a step. So it's a flight of stairs, right? That's life. Everyone wants to grow. So, you know, the first lots of entrepreneurs like Narayana Murthy and, you know, stuff like that, and say, hold on, we can do this too. And therefore, that's what it is. It's all about saying, oh, that company did so well, and he or she comes from a relatively similar background. I can do it too. He or she does it. Next comes and does it. So it just needs an initial pioneer to move. That's already, that gate is already opened, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, there's no stopping now. And therefore, every cycle, you keep seeing better entrepreneurs, not because he or she suddenly better than the person in 2002 or 5 or 10. It's just that he or she's got more exposure. Maybe they've worked in some startups and grown there versus the first batch that they do everything on their own. Now you've got serial entrepreneurs who do the second startup and they get 20 million on day one check, maybe 50 million on day one. So the ecosystem is evolving. It's still very nascent in India. We're still $2,000 GDP country. We're peanut, right? We've got a long way to go. It's like a glass half full or half empty. You know, you decide in life. If you want to be a pessimist, you can pick that side of the glass. If you want to be an optimist like I am, you pick the right side of the glass.
Great points there, Sasha. One last question before we jump into the rapid fire, you know, and we spoke about this before, you know, starting the podcast. What are your thoughts on, you know, building a legacy institutional VC fund? Because I'm sure it's very tough to do that. You know, it's still a very partner-driven game where, you know, founders look for those kind of personalities in the GPs, but not necessarily everyone in the fund has that kind of skill set. It's difficult to pass that on to the juniors in the team. So what are your thoughts on, you know, building a legacy institutional fund that continues to exist even beyond yourself?
Yeah, so if you ask me, that's my number one priority. If I had to think of 10 years from now, you and me having a drink, I should not be in K Capital, right? I'm looking at random time. It can't be 20 years from now, period of time. And any deal that comes up and you say, oh, that was a great deal, I say, oh, I didn't even know about it. That'll be success for me. You know, I'm measuring myself on that, saying I should be out of the picture, irrelevant. No one should remember my name, but people should remember K Capital. Then I've succeeded versus everyone saying, oh, Sasha did this and that. That's ridiculous. So I'm finding many ways to ensure that it happens. It takes time. It takes its own path in life, as you can imagine. But it always starts with making sure you hire and partner with people who are much smarter than you. So that thing we've already done. And I'm not that smart, so it's easy for me to do that. Anyone can be better. But to be honest, my partners and colleagues are anyway very competent people. And they're already substantially smarter than me. And they're only getting, the gap is just increasing. So which is great. It's not that difficult for me to do this. It'll take a couple more years and be done.
Awesome. Some great points, and you know, I would have wished to keep going, but just in the interest of time, we'll move into our final segment, the rapid fire. I'll ask a few questions and, you know, hope to get your honest opinions on the same.
Yeah, let's try. I'm not good at rapid fire, but let's try.
Okay. One thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem.
I wish everyone could move back to Mumbai and to Nariman Point. I love my office there, but that's become like a tourist destination now. Everyone's moved to Bangalore. And of course, I'm just kidding. All my partners and colleagues, every single one of them now lives in Bangalore. I'm the only one left in Bombay, but I don't take any board seats anyway. But I miss those days where all my friends, the ecosystem, the offices, everything was in Nariman Point. It was just fantastic. But that's long gone and life goes on.
And from an ecosystem standpoint, you know, what would you like to change? You know, of course, we're evolving as an ecosystem. We're getting better. Like you said, the quality of entrepreneurs, VCs is improving. But what should we, you know, focus on more to grow even faster?
I think we are doing what we have to do, right? In the sense that we want even more VC funds in the ecosystem. You would like an exit mechanism in this country where, like in China, you have Starboard, in the US, you have NASDAQ. Can we have exits in India through a mechanism where companies don't have to go to the US or Asia to list? Should be able to do it here. So the NSE, BSE, all are making very good efforts and understand the issues. But I think even more needs to be done and quicker.
The most unusual, memorable pitch meeting that you remember with a founder?
So many. I remember once an entrepreneur got a dog, if I remember, a dog into the pitch. And I was like, what's going on? And it was a pet food brand. And he put some food, which was like regular food that is available in the market. And then he put what, you know, he was proposing to make. And obviously the dog ate his, like lapped it up and left the other one. So it was a great laugh. It was a great pitch. Super fun.
Last question. VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to?
So too many, you know. Founders, I would say, I won't pick a name because the reality is that I respect any person who tries. So any founder, you know, his or her company shut down in 3 months or 3 weeks, let alone someone building a $6 billion company, I respect. Because life's about trying. What are you doing right now? You're trying. I already respect you versus pontificating on the sidelines. The world is full of pontificators and lecturers and, you know, throwing crap out there, people, and, you know, I would do this and dreaming. Life's not dreaming, boss, is doing. So he or she's tried. I respect you immediately. And I'm not going to differentiate between you and someone who's built a big company, because how are you any less? Both tried, someone worked, some didn't work. So I respect every single founder. As far as VCs, I have so many friends who I respect. There's some super smart people all over the Indian ecosystem. I have several friends in the US. If I go through names, we'll go through crazy amounts. But I would pick people in my own peer group, right? Early stage funds, because we all started together. So I'd pick founders of, say, firms like Bloom, I respect a lot. I respect IQ founders a lot. And then, of course, other early stage funds. I'm not picking all of them. But let's take my ex-colleague, Anil Joshi. He started a fund of his own, Unicorn Ventures. And so like that, I like to pick people in my peer group.
Awesome. This has been an incredible conversation, Sasha. You know, any last thoughts for aspiring founders as well as current founders who are listening to this?
Stop dreaming, guys. Get on with it. Go get started. It's the best thing in the world to start something. It's very difficult. Be ready before you jump in. But once you jump in, there's no going back. And I think you'll really enjoy the journey.
I think that's a perfect note to, you know, end the show today. Sasha, thank you so much for taking out the time for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully we'll have you back on the show. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for the invite. And everyone, be safe, folks. Be safe.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruna podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.